The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 88333, Alabama against James Lewis Smith.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in North Carolina versus Pierce, this Court established a prophylactic rule, a presumption of vindictiveness, to correct due process violations by courts that sentenced a defendant to more time after a successful appeal. The evil sought to be corrected was retaliation for successfully appealing. In this case, Smith, the respondent, appealed his guilty plea, and upon retrial, his sentence on the burglary charge was enhanced from 30 years to life. He was also sentenced to life on the reinstated sodomy charge and given 150 years on the rape conviction to run consecutively to the other charges. Later cases by this Court has established that the Pierce presumption only applies to situations in which a realistic likelihood of vindictiveness exists because of the severity of the presumption, which may operate in the absence of proof of improper motive and thereby block a legitimate state response to criminal conduct.
Let me get one thing straight in my mind, Mr. Bureberg.
Yes.
The original appeal to the Alabama, was it the Court of Criminal Appeals in this case, was on the basis that the guilty plea had not been knowingly made?
The narrow basis was that the defendant was not told the correct minimum and maximum possible range of sentences under our habitual felony offender statute and an enhancement statute when a weapon or dangerous instrument is used. It was not based on a violation of Boykin.
Yeah. So he appealed his sentence on the guilty plea, and the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals upheld his appeal and, what, sent it back for resentencing without that guilty plea?
The Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals sent it back for a retrial.
For a trial, yeah,
right.
Rather than a plea.
Yes. What the petitioner, the state of Alabama, is asking this court to consider in this particular case is, in a retrial after a guilty plea, that since there are other readily apparent explanations for the increased sentence on the retrial, that there is no need for the evidentiary aid, namely the presumption that Pierce created.
So it's not important that there was a plea bargain in this case?
It is important that there was a plea. That's the underlying premise, I guess, of our whole
plea bargain.
I'm sorry, there was a plea bargain.
Is that relevant to your case, or is your case the same as if there had just been a guilty plea?
It's important that there was a plea bargain in our case because in the plea bargain, the prosecutor and the court are oftentimes, or always almost, engaging in in exchange for that plea bargain, either sentencing concessions or charge concessions, as in this case. So the fact that there is a plea bargain, I think, is very important in that it throws this case into the U.S. versus Brady and the Santabella line of cases where it's acceptable to, in exchange for a guilty plea, to offer sentencing concessions and charge concessions.
Well, how often are there guilty pleas entered without a plea bargain? Isn't that characteristic of guilty pleas?
I would say the very vast majority are entered with a plea bargain. Yes, sir.
I'm not quite sure why that makes the case different from just any guilty plea. If there had been no plea bargain, you would not be making the arguments you're making today. Because I thought the base of your argument was that the judge became aware of additional facts at the trial that changed his mind on the appropriate sentence. Couldn't that happen without a plea?
The basis really is that the resulting increase in the sentence after the trial is based on this guilty plea because of the lack of information established at the factual information established at the guilty plea.
Was there any factual information that the prosecutor obtained that he didn't have at the time of the guilty plea? I know the judge didn't have as much knowledge of the facts until it was tried. Is there any indication that the prosecutor discovered anything that he could not have advised the court about at the time the original sentence was imposed?
Not in this record, no, sir. No.
So I suppose that the rule you would argue for is one that, as long as the prosecutor doesn't tell the judge everything that might come out of the trial, and the defendant sets aside the guilty plea by unconstitutional grounds, whatever it might be, there could always be an increase in sentence if the judge thinks it's appropriate.
The focus of our case really is not the knowledge or the lack of knowledge of the facts that the prosecutor might have,
But what the judge has. And I'm suggesting to you that under your rule, if I understand you correctly, if the prosecutor just withholds from the judge, just not purposely, but just doesn't tell the judge all of the facts that might come out at the trial, and then the judge learns something extra about the defendant's behavior at the trial, the judge could always enhance the sentence.
The judge will always be in our position, in our situation, in have knowledge of more facts in a trial situation.
Right. And so therefore could always enhance the sentence.
Yes. And that's one of the basic, what I've characterized as the readily apparent other reasons, other than vindictiveness, which is the heart of Pierce.
But he could always overcome whatever would be left of the presumption of vindictiveness in every case.
Well, the rule we're arguing for is that
he'll be followed by a trial at which he learns something more.
Yes.
Yeah. How is this case different from Pierce?
This case essentially is different from Pierce in that in Pierce there was an initial trial and an appeal and then a subsequent trial.
That wasn't true as to the co-respondent in Pierce, Rice.
Rice pleaded guilty, correct.
And in Pierce we held a vindictiveness rule applied. So aren't you asking us to overrule Pierce in part?
No. Well, we're not asking the
court. How do you distinguish this case from the position of the respondent Rice in Pierce?
The narrow focus of this court in Rice was on whether or not a defendant under due process was entitled to credit for time served. And as Rice came through the system, Rice was not given credit for his time served. And the narrow focus really in Rice is he's constitutionally entitled to that time. The other aspect of the...
That's not what was the basis of our disposition. We quoted what Judge Johnson had said, that the state of Alabama offered no evidence attempting to justify the increase, and that he found it shocking. And we agreed with that conclusion. I don't see how your case is really can be decided in your favor without overruling Pierce, the Rice portion of Pierce.
Right. Part of what was not in Rice that we feel is in our particular case is the influence of the plea bargaining that was not sanctioned by this court until U.S. v. Brady, which was subsequent to Pierce. So that it's that aspect of the plea bargaining that becomes important and which distinguishes or which allows this court to rule in our way without overruling Rice. The other readily apparent fact that the reason for the increased sentence is not as a result of vindictiveness is that in the guilty plea context, the judge and prosecutor, but primarily the judge since we're discussing sentencers, is extending leniency in exchange for that guilty plea. And this court in U.S. v. its previous decisions has held that the state is entitled to extend leniency or sentencing concessions to those who plead guilty. That was in Corbett versus New Jersey. And that is the other readily apparent explanation for the increased sentence at the subsequent retrial. So the fact.
But that's also an explanation that would be present in every guilty plea case.
Yes. Yeah. The other readily apparent explanation other than vindictiveness, which I've pointed to in our brief, is that at the retrial of the case, the court then is much more aware of the defendant's mental and moral attitudes concerning his own rehabilitation and attitudes in the case. And this is illustrated by the facts in this particular case. The judge stated that his decision in increasing the sentence on the retrial was partially based on the defendant's outlook on it, meaning the case, the defendant's position during trial, and, quote, what you said at it, meaning the trial. So apparent reference to what the judge considered to be the defendant's perjury. So this explanation also is readily apparent on the retrial of a case. And this is a sufficient explanation for the enhanced sentence versus a presumption that the enhanced sentence is, in fact, the product of vindictiveness. As Mr. Justice
now said, the respondent tells us that there is some evidence of actual vindictiveness here. Would that question, even if we were to agree with you, be open on remand to resolve?
I believe it would be that the Alabama Supreme Court could then engage in or remand it to the Court of Criminal Appeals for them to determine whether or not there is evidence of actual vindictiveness. And I think that's another aspect of this case that's not before this court. The part of the Pierce was protecting the defendant from the fear or the apprehension of vindictive sentencing. But that is not present in this case because obviously the defendant was not afraid of appealing. And in fact, Michigan versus Payne. This court made the same type of statement so the only issue really before this court then would be the issue of vindictiveness, not the apprehension of the vindictiveness. I believe that the facts of this case fully support or illustrate the points that I'm trying to make, namely that at retrial, the judge will always be in possession of more knowledge concerning the facts and the defendant's attitudes concerning his participation in the crime than he is in the guilty plea proceeding that started the process. In our case, at the guilty plea sentencing, the defendant did admit that he had a knife. He did admit to having sexual intercourse with the victim in this crime. However, what was left out and which was subsequently developed at the trial was the atrociousness of the crime, the fact that this attack lasted for over an hour, and the fact that not just one act of non-consensual sexual intercourse occurred, but that four acts of rape and two acts of sodomy were performed on this woman while the defendant was holding a knife to her throat. Now, that idea is contested by the respondent, the idea of the knife being held to the defendant's throat. But there was a demonstration by the victim in the record, which the judge, observing it later in a motion for new trial, determined that that was what was happening. And there's no doubt that the defendant was threatening the victim throughout this ordeal with the use of the knife. So it's that relationship between the lack of information at a guilty plea versus the full information that the trial judge or the sentencing judge will have that makes the presumption of vindictiveness not appropriate in this narrow situation. The other issue we petitioned, well, if I may, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Bierberg. Mr. Larkin?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The second question presented in this case, the one Mr. Bierberg was just about to advert to, concerns the type of information on which a judge may rely in increasing the sentence a defendant first received when he pled guilty. That question has considerable practical importance for the federal government because under the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984, a judge must always state his reasons for imposing a sentence. So the circumstances in which a judge in a case like this may increase a sentence directly bears on that second question and is of considerable importance to us. The respondent argues that when a defendant withdraws from a guilty plea, he can never thereafter have his sentence increased based on evidence that is developed at a trial, and that even if he can, he could not have his own sentence increased in this case because the reasons given by the trial judge were insufficient. We think that respondent's arguments are wrong as a matter of law and are irrational as a matter of policy. The McCulloch case decided by this court 3 years ago made clear that a trial judge at a second sentencing proceeding may impose an enhanced sentence on a defendant if the judge relies on new and objective facts, facts that were unknown to the judge when he first sentenced the defendant. That condition was satisfied here. As Mr. Bierberg explained, at the time the judge resentenced the defendant, he said that he was unaware that numerous rapes and sodomies had occurred on the night in question, and he said he was unaware that the victim had been threatened with a knife.
Do you think that approach is consistent with the court's decision in the Rice case, the companion case to Pierce?
But in the Rice case, the court applied a presumption, and the court said that the state of Alabama in that case at no time sought to dispel that presumption. Here, even if a presumption applies, under McCulloch, it's clear the presumption can be rebutted. And therefore, the McCulloch case and the Rice case have to be read together. If Rice adopts a presumption that would be applicable here, and we don't think the court necessarily has to agree with that, but even if it does, under McCulloch, that presumption can be rebutted. And the judge's reasons in this case are sufficient under McCulloch to rebut that presumption.
But this case, he relied solely on the Rice case. The opinion cited Rice.
Correct, Your Honor.
They relied on Rice alone.
Correct.
And we have to say they're wrong.
Correct. We don't think that the court should have to read Rice to govern this case. Justice Kennedy asked that question, and I don't think you would have to overrule Rice in order to rule in the state's favor on the first question. There are two different aspects of the ruling in Pierce. The first is the due process ruling that a defendant cannot be vindictively sentenced simply for having successfully set aside the first judgment. That is a basic due process principle, but is not necessarily the one that is at issue in a case like this one. That part, as Justice O'Connor asked, deals with the question of actual vindictiveness, and a defendant can always attempt to show actual vindictiveness. But what's at concern here in the first question is whether you should presume that the sentence the judge imposed at the second sentencing proceeding was retaliatory in nature. Now, in Rice, it's true, the court did apply that presumption. But Rice was the companion case to Pierce, which first adopted this rule. Rice preceded, therefore, this court's decisions in cases like Bordenkercher and Corbett. And those cases are significant because those cases make clear that you can extend leniency to a defendant who accepts responsibility and enters a plea, and you can deny the same leniency to a defendant who refuses to accept responsibility and instead elects to go to trial. So it's that type of rule, which the court has labeled a prophylactic rule, that's at issue in the first question. And just as the court has been willing in a variety of contexts, such as the exclusionary rule or the application of Miranda, to modify prophylactic rules when new situations show that it may be irrational to apply that rule in other contexts, so too the court should be willing to modify the type of rule that was applied to Rice himself in light of the changed circumstances that have gone on in the 20-some-odd years we've had since the Pierce case was decided.
You're saying this rule would apply only to plea bargains, then?
No, I think as an empirical matter, the correlation between this rule and plea bargains is going to be very high. But I would think it could also apply in a case where someone just enters a plea.
Not if you distinguish Rice the way you've just proposed.
Well, if you distinguish Rice that way and you exclude the plea bargaining process, then yes. But I think one of the reasons for excluding the plea bargaining process is that in that process, it's well accepted. In fact, the dissent in the court below stated that it was a custom to afford a defendant leniency in exchange for a plea. Now, there will also be cases where a judge extends a defendant leniency in exchange for a plea where there's no plea bargain. That would probably happen normally in what would be called misdemeanors and minor offenses, not major felonies, where someone maybe isn't even represented by a lawyer and pleads guilty. A judge may, in that circumstance, also extend leniency to a defendant simply because the defendant has come in and said, I did it, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, and I accept responsibility. In fact, the federal sentencing guidelines have elevated this custom to a rule. A defendant who accepts responsibility under a plea bargain or not, or even after going to trial, is entitled to credit. So if you were to limit Rice in the way I said, just to plea bargains, then you wouldn't have to, as Justice Kennedy asked, overrule the Rice case. However, it's possible that the rationale for limiting Rice to plea bargains would also apply in other cases where there was no plea bargain because the judge, in fact, bestowed leniency on someone for pleading guilty. Now, respondent makes much ado of two facts in trying to say that the judge did not adequately rebut the presumption here. Respondent first argues that the judge relied on his subjective impression as to the crimes. That's true, but it's immaterial. As long as the judge relies on new and objective information, a judge is entitled to reevaluate the heinousness of the crime or the incorrigibility of the defendant in coming to a decision as to what particular sentence best serves the deterrent and retributive functions of the law. The respondent also argues that there were no new facts elicited regarding the burglary rather than the sexual assaults. That fact is irrelevant. What the judge did here essentially was put together a sentencing package to try to decide what sentence best served the functions of the law and ensured that in this particular case, for example, the respondent either never is released from prison or is released only after serving a very long prison term. There's no requirement in this court's decisions, and in fact, the decisions in Wassman and McCullough are to the contrary, that the new facts directly relate to the crime for which the defendant is sentenced. The McCullough decision and the Wassman decision basically show that what the court has done, and I believe sensibly, has been to reevaluate through experience the circumstances in which the presumption should apply and in which the presumption can be rebutted. That type of reevaluation was properly applied in this case. The judgment below should therefore be reversed.
Mr. Larkin, if we agree with you, why shouldn't we give the Supreme Court of Alabama the chance to decide on this thing without the benefit of the presumption? I mean, even if we agree that the presumption should not have been applied, shouldn't the Supreme Court of Alabama have a chance to decide for itself whether, even absent a presumption, there is evidence of bias here?
Yes. A defendant can always argue in a particular case that this judge, notwithstanding anything else, gave me 5 extra years or whatever simply because I went to trial, and that's not permitted by Pierce. And that's the type of claim a defendant can make. Once the evidence is all considered, is then for an appellate court to make that the inquiry whether the defendant is correct.
And that inquiry hasn't been made here, so it would still be available to the Supreme Court of Alabama to make that inquiry, no?
You're correct on both counts. Okay. It was not made, and it's Alabama Supreme Court can't consider it on remand. If there are no further questions.
Very well, Mr. Larkin. Ms. Boyd, we'll hear from you when we resume at 1 o'clock. We'll resume the argument in Alabama against Smith. Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I want to begin by trying to restore the proper factual context for this case, and I will start with the question raised by Justice Stevens, whether plea bargaining is at all critical to this Court's determination of the case. The answer is absolutely not. Plea bargaining as a practice, as a policy, is not implicated on the facts of this case. What we have here is a simple guilty plea that results in a conviction. The defendant is charged with 3 crimes. The plea agreement is quite simple. He pleads guilty to 2 of those crimes. In exchange, the prosecutor agrees to drop the third. There is no concession.
Well, isn't that a bargain?
There was a bargain that included...
That's the bargain.
It is a...
He gives up the right to trial in exchange for pleading to two instead of three offenses.
Justice O'Connor, that's absolutely correct. What is distinguishable, though, is that the bargain did not include any negotiations or concessions at all with reference to sentencing. Why that is critical is that the state has lost absolutely no advantage. When that guilty plea conviction was reversed, all the state did was reinstate the third crime. And the defendant then went to trial on all three crimes. So we don't have the usual situation, as is suggested in the cases presented by both the government and the state, of a defendant and the prosecutor, sometimes involving the judge, hassling about a sentence. And the defendant then changing his mind because he gets a sentence that he didn't believe that he should have gotten, then wanting to withdraw the guilty plea. This is not just a withdrawn guilty plea. This is a conviction that gets reversed because the sentencing judge made errors that invalidated the guilty plea on constitutional grounds.
Well, do you concede that at least as to the third charge that was restored when he went to trial, that the judge had complete flexibility within the statutory sentencing scheme to sentence for that offense?
Justice O'Connor, that is clear on the record. It's important, though, that that crime is not before this court. It wasn't before the Alabama Supreme Court, and it's not before this court. This court and the Alabama Supreme Court have just one conviction and one sentence to deal with. That is the sentence that had to do with burglary. Not rape, not sodomy. The question here is classic Pierce question. In the instance when a sentencing judge applies a sentence upon a conviction, whether it's based on a guilty plea or based on a jury verdict, may that same sentencing judge, upon reconviction, come back and enhance the sentence. The Rice case that dealt with Pierce, that was affirmed by this court in Pierce, is precisely on point. I take issue with the state in suggesting that this is not the Rice case.
What about the sodomy charge, Ms. Boyd? That was the subject of the original one. That was one of the counts that was subject to the original guilty plea, wasn't it?
No, sir.
It was not?
Burglary and rape and sodomy were all charged. The defendant pled guilty to burglary. He pled guilty to rape. The sodomy indictment was dismissed. The defendant then received 30-year concurrent sentences on burglary and rape. Mr. Chief Justice, you inquired earlier about why
30 years on each?
Yes, sir.
Concurrent.
Concurrent.
Mm-hmm.
It was a sentence of from 2 to 30 years?
No, sir. No, Your Honor. The sentence was a 30-year sentence for burglary, a 30-year sentence for rape. They were to run concurrently. Thereafter, the defendant exercised a right that the Alabama statutes provided him. That right was to appeal to the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals the constitutional sufficiency of the conviction based on the guilty plea. He appealed it, Mr. Chief Justice, responding to your earlier question, he appealed it because he believed that he was not mentally coherent when the guilty plea was taken and that therefore the guilty plea itself was deficient. Now, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals did not address that specific contention, but found, nevertheless, that the guilty plea was constitutionally deficient because the trial judge had absolutely refused or declined to properly inform the defendant of the maximum sentence he was exposing himself to by pleading guilty. That's a constitutional prerequisite. Therefore, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals very reluctantly said, "We have no choice but to vacate this conviction." Thereafter, he went to trial on all three cases.
And what charge was added again?
Sodomy. Sodomy at that point was reinstituted, and that is why, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, the state has lost nothing in its bargain. That is why we don't have to inquire whether leniency ought to be given to
the defendant. Well, what were the new sentences?
The new sentences were these: burglary, life; sodomy, life, to run concurrent; on the rape 150 years to run consecutive to the other sentences. For whatever reason, trial counsel chose not to appeal to the Alabama Supreme Court the convictions on the rape and the convictions on the sodomy. The Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals, in fact, remanded the rape conviction, indicating that that 150-year sentence exceeded the statutorily permissible sentence. So the only sentence that should command our attention is the life sentence for burglary. And why does Pierce apply? Pierce applies.
You think the rape sentence has been set aside entirely?
It has not yet, because the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals remanded that. Thereafter, the state petition for cert, everything has been put on hold. But the trial court...
Anyway, it's not in effect. It was set aside, wasn't it?
In effect, it was set aside as statutorily exceeding the maximum.
All right, thanks.
Why does Pierce apply? In this case, we don't, Justice Scalia, have to remand the case to the Alabama Supreme Court. I believe Justice O'Connor raised that same inquiry. Should we send it back and make some determination on actual vindictiveness? No, that determination has been made. This defendant raised his realistic apprehension of retaliatory motivation at the trial court. He raised it in a motion for a new trial. He raised it at the outset when he tried to get this judge to recuse himself. And he had very good reason for being apprehensive. So that there are really two reasons.
Well, I didn't think the Court of Appeal had addressed itself to that question of actual vindictiveness.
Justice O'Connor, the Court of Appeals did not detail in its opinion any analysis of it. But as I read the Alabama Supreme Court opinion, it held that the presumption wasn't overcome. It addressed itself to whether the trial court could rely upon the information elucidated at trial about the details of the offense. Before it could make that inquiry, it had to consider the defendant's arguments, and the defendant's arguments were simple. We believe that this judge is penalizing us because we chose to appeal the guilty plea conviction.
Well, I thought the Supreme Court of Alabama applied the Pierce presumption, and that was how the case was resolved. I didn't understand it to have addressed the actual vindictiveness question.
The Pierce presumption is a presumption of vindictiveness upon the occurrence of certain facts.
Right. I didn't understand that the Supreme Court of Alabama ever looked at the question of whether there was actual vindictiveness here.
Its opinion does not set forth an analysis. The fact that it looked at it has to be suggested by the fact that it went on to determine whether it was overcome. It determined whether the trial court could rely upon details of the crime as they were elucidated at trial. Another reason we know
I'm not sure I'm understanding you. If you have a presumption, you don't have to listen to the defendant's evidence. I mean, he may say, boy, this judge was really vindictive. The judge would say, I don't have to listen to that. We take as a given that he's vindictive. That's what the presumption means.
Pierce,
it's up to the state to refute that presumption. Isn't that what the Alabama court did? That's what I thought it did.
What the Alabama court did, Your Honor, was say that the evidence that was offered by the state
was not enough.
Was not enough.
To overcome the presumption.
Wasn't overcome.
Right. But now, if we disagree with that, and this is what Justice O'Connor and I were getting to, if we disagree with that, if we think there shouldn't have been a presumption, we would still have to send it back so that Alabama could then consider, had there not been a presumption, would we have found on the facts that there was vindictiveness? Don't you think we'd have to do that?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that there is ample evidence on this record to support the Supreme Court's finding. Now, to answer you directly, if you disagree with that, the proper inquiry would be to send it back for specific findings on the presence of vindictiveness.
Right.
But in so doing, you would not, based on your own case, though, be asking the Alabama Supreme Court to actually find actual vindictiveness because...
Unless we disagreed that Pierce was applicable here.
Yes, Your Honor. The point I'm about to make is that actual vindictiveness, because it is so difficult to ascertain, can be a function of a finding that there are realistic indicators here that support a likelihood of vindictiveness.
But those are two different inquiries. One is whether the vindictiveness is so likely under a particular set of facts that there ought to be a presumption of vindictiveness. And then even if you say no, there are enough other explanations in cases like this, so you don't apply a presumption of vindictiveness, you could still find actual vindictiveness.
I agree. And that is what McCullough and that's what most of the case law after Pierce say. My point is, if you believe that the Alabama Supreme Court did not make a finding of actual vindictiveness, I'm simply suggesting that the record here shows that the finding was based on realistic likelihood of vindictiveness, that there's enough in the record.
But that goes to the presumption. That goes to whether the presumption should apply and not to whether there was in fact actual vindictiveness.
The presumption should apply, Your Honor.
That's what you say, but the state disagrees.
Well, let me go directly to some reasoning for why the presumption should apply. When this court in Pierce talked about whether we look to an actual evidence of motivation or whether there are other indicators, it gave guidance in the case law that followed. One reason this presumption ought to apply here is that we have the very same sentencing authority who has demonstrated on this record both a personal interest and an institutional interest in having a retaliatory motivation against this defendant.
Suppose this were a different judge. All the facts are the same except it's a different judge on the second time around. What result?
Well,
a presumption?
This court has held that a different judge would make a difference. I believe that on the facts of this case, there would be a lesser likelihood of vindictiveness with a different judge. I'm not willing to embrace as a general rule a different judge makes a difference. But in this case, this particular judge had so integrated himself on the issue of guilt at the first sentencing hearing that I think these facts are distinguishable. These facts require the presumption.
But I thought that in considering whether the Pierce presumption should apply in a given situation, we look to the generality of cases and the likelihood of whether in all cases there's such a realistic likelihood of vindictiveness that we should, in fact, apply a presumption. I didn't think we did it case by case to say, gee, on these facts, should we have a presumption?
Although this court's opinion in McCullough, the majority opinion, was not embraced by this entire court, it specifically suggested that it is a case-by-case analysis that ought to be employed because of the difficulty in ascertaining actual vindictiveness. This case almost cries out for an analysis of this judge's role. Here is a judge who admits on the record, before he makes the first sentence, that he has received from the defendant, without knowledge of the defendant's lawyers, letters which, in his own statement, bear out, substantiate, and corroborate the defendant's guilt. Here is a judge who, at the initial sentencing hearing, expresses on the record that he himself is convinced of the defendant's guilt, calls up to the bench someone totally unrelated to the proceedings, the defendant's alleged girlfriend, hands her the letters that the court has received ex parte, and says to her, you read them. And after she concludes them, makes the inquiry now, are you as satisfied as I am that he is guilty? Here's a judge who moves on a motion for recusal after the conviction is overturned, and again indicates, I received your letters. I know you're guilty. What greater interest does he need to evince when he has to sit through a trial, presumably to determine an issue that he's already made up his mind on?
May I ask you a question at this point? I don't understand your position. Is it your view that whenever a judge takes a guilty plea and has maybe a hearing to be sure there's enough factual support to take the plea, that thereafter the judge is disqualified from trying the case if the plea later is withdrawn? Because in every case, the judge has pretty good reason to believe the defendant's guilty if he's entered a plea.
No, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is that there needs to be an analysis of whether the sentencing judge has so completely engaged himself in the factual issue about the guilt at the initial sentencing hearing, that his impartiality...
But doesn't he have a duty to do that? Isn't that a normal thing to do for a trial judge? To make sure the defendant's guilty and get some sense of the seriousness of the crime to inform him or her on what sentence to impose?
What is not normal is what the trial judge did here. In addition to taking the guilty plea and ascertaining the factual basis, he read letters that were sent to him
by the defendant
without advice of counsel, without knowledge of counsel, and he stated his own adoption of the implications of guilt that came in those letters, and that guided him as he went to the retrial.
That was after the defendant had entered a guilty plea.
It was before his sentencing, however.
Yes, I understand, but I don't see why it's wrong after a defendant has entered a guilty plea for the judge to accept whatever factual information might come to his attention that corroborated the fact of guilt. I just don't understand.
Well, if that judge was not the same judge to proceed with the retrial.
Well, but I think what you're really arguing is that the judge who accepts a guilty plea should never handle the retrial.
No, I'm not arguing that, Your Honor. This judge should not have handled the retrial.
All the things that you say that this judge did only go to convincing him that this defendant was guilty. But a judge should always be convinced that the defendant's guilty before he accepts a guilty plea. You don't want a judge accepting a guilty plea unless he believes the defendant's guilty, do you? So the situation you're complaining about will always exist when there's been an acceptance of a guilty plea.
What this judge did went beyond the initial guilty plea, Your Honor. The defendant had...
Much the better. He was really sure the guy was guilty. You're not...
Well, what do we do with the defendant's due process right to believe that he's going to have a fair trial at the hand of a judge who has no predisposition?
I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about your answer to Justice Stevens' question. Don't you have to answer Justice Stevens' question? Yes. Whenever you're sent back, you can't have the same judge who's accepted your guilty plea.
That is the preferred procedure. That is not, from a policy point of view, a practical procedure. And that is why I did not embrace that as what I'm asking this court to do. This court doesn't even have to go that far. This court needs only analyze what information the judge had at the time of the second sentencing and whether that information disqualified him from making sentence free from vindictiveness.
You're almost arguing that the judge should have disqualified himself from trying the case.
He was asked to do so, and he was asked to do so because the defendant had a reasonable basis.
That isn't the point here. The Alabama courts didn't decide in your client's favor on the basis that the judge should have disqualified himself. They decided in your client's favor on the basis that the Pierce presumption applied.
The Pierce presumption, Your Honor, as I read Rice and the underlying case, is grounded on a due process right that recognizes not only actual vindictiveness, but a defendant's perception of vindictiveness. So by asking this judge to disqualify himself, the defendant himself was indicating his own belief that he could not have a fair trial at the hands of this judge. Why does that matter for the Pierce presumption? It matters for the Pierce presumption because it goes to whether there is a realistic likelihood of actual vindictiveness. A retrial here was necessary solely because the sentencing judge made errors of a constitutional magnitude. That was a finding of the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals. And it was a finding that was very scathing as to the omissions of the trial judge.
May I ask one other question about the procedure here? Maybe it doesn't affect the legal arguments, but do I correctly understand that the third charge, which was dismissed during the plea negotiations, was the sodomy charge? And after trial, he was convicted of sodomy and given a life sentence on that charge. And you don't challenge that life sentence?
It was not challenged below, and that's why it's not here.
So it's not before. So regardless of how we decide this case, this gentleman would probably spend the same amount of time.
Well, the difference is that the sentences were to run concurrently. Well,
they do run concurrently, don't they?
Burglary and sodomy at the second sentences were both life sentences running concurrently. The 150-year rape sentence was a consecutive sentence. So So what your determination is on the burglary affects the sodomy anyway. And I'm sure that is perhaps why trial counsel did not raise that in the
court
below.
You say it does or does not affect
it? It does affect it because it's a sentence that's running concurrently. It is the same sentence, life, and it's running concurrently
with
the one that's
if we vacate the burglary sentence, if you totally vacate the burglary sentence, the sodomy sentence would stand, wouldn't it?
The sodomy sentence would stand. I believe that it would have to go back to the court for the sodomy sentence would stand. It's simply a running.
I understand the legal issue is there and all the rest of it, but it really doesn't make an awful lot of difference to your client how we try this case, how we decide this case as I see it.
Well, I think it does, Your Honor. If this court is still to give any credence to whether we ought to be concerned about the defendant's right to be free from the apprehension of a retaliatory motivation, it matters to Mr. Smith whether the burglary sentence.
Well, I understand that argument, yeah.
But it wouldn't affect at all the length of time he would serve on the sodomy.
It would not, but then again, he is still free to make some appellate challenges on the sodomy sentence because we haven't gone back on remand yet. He's still free, perhaps, because the trial court has not entered any orders after the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals and after the Alabama Supreme Court's vacation. He's still free, perhaps, to deal with the federal habeas
charges. Well, the Alabama Supreme Court seemed to think that it should decide the validity of the burglary sentence.
That it should or should not?
That it should.
That was the only thing before it.
Yes. Well, but the sodomy sentence was there. Why do they want to decide the validity of the burglary sentence?
I was not trial counsel. I do not know why that was not brought up to the Alabama Supreme Court. But the defendant may still have federal habeas challenges to deal with the sodomy. So it does matter what this court does with burglary. The burglary sentence was enhanced. And it was.
Well, you still would have to exhaust your state remedies with respect to the.
And whether they have been exhausted is still in question because it hasn't gone back on remand.
Or whether they would now be procedurally barred. And
I think both issues are still open because of the procedural posture of this case. So it does matter what this court does. Let me turn to the issue of if Pierce applies, has it been overcome? In that connection, we do not advance the absolute rule that the government suggests, and that is that a trial court should never be free to consider facts of the offense as they're revealed at trial. That is not our argument. Our argument is, number one, Pierce requires the trial court to affirmatively record on the record, and this trial judge didn't do it. We're not talking about rape. We're not talking about sodomy. The question is whether this trial judge advanced anything at all on the record to justify enhancing a 30-year burglary sentence to life. The record is absolutely void, and under Pierce, that should end the inquiry. The government and the state suggest that this is some type of package deal, and the trial court should have had the right to listen to the details of the rape at trial and consider that enhancing the sentence. Why that's fallacious is that all three crimes call for separate penalties.
Well, but we allow, even when crimes are not prosecuted simultaneously with the crime that he's being sentenced for, and indeed, even when he hasn't been convicted of them yet, we allow, at the penalty phase, other crimes to be considered or other unlawful conduct to be considered in deciding what punishment to impose for this one.
Justice Scalia, that may be the case, but we don't need to speculate that this trial judge did consider those other crimes. There's nothing on the record that suggests that he decided to enhance the burglary because of evidence he heard on rape, because he also enhanced the rape.
Well,
it could very well be that the evidence he heard on rape and sodomy was so atrocious that he decided to make the enhancement there.
Well, look, he did say, I didn't know that there had been so many rapes. I didn't know there had been sodomy before. And your only complaint is that he didn't go ahead and say, and for that reason, I am imposing a higher sentence, not only on rape and sodomy, but also on the burglary count. It is just his failure to mention the word burglary is what your case comes down to.
Well, Pierce requires him to justify each sentence. We shouldn't have to speculate that the justification for burglary, especially since the record doesn't show any new evidence, the justification for burglary ought to be the justification.
It shows new evidence of other crime.
Ms. Boyd, I'm reading from the Supreme Court of Alabama opinion at page 3 of the appendix. And as I understand, this is Justice Jones, in his opinion, giving a summary of what had happened. After a sentencing hearing, the petitioner was sentenced to life imprisonment for the conviction of first-degree sodomy, which term was to run concurrently with a life term for the first-degree burglary conviction. The petitioner was also sentenced to a term of 150 years for the conviction of first-degree rape. Now, is that a correct statement of what happened?
That is a correct statement.
So the 150-year consecutive sentence is for rape?
Yes. Initially, the concurrent sentences were for burglary and rape. Initially, Your Honor, that was the 30-year concurrent sentence. Upon retrial, what ran concurrently were the burglary and sodomy, and the consecutive sentence was rape. That is what you're reading now. The Alabama Supreme Court, upon after the second sentencing.
Well, getting back to the burglary conviction, the element of the offense of burglary is entry with the intent to commit a crime. And so the crime that was committed, it seems to me, does necessarily and logically enhance the burglary sentence itself, so that the trial judge was entitled, based on this record, to consider the nature of the offense that was committed after the burglary in sentencing for the burglary. That's part of the definition of the crime.
Justice Kennedy, the legislative scheme for punishment of burglary, rape, and sodomy took into consideration the fact that a burglary is entry of a residence to commit another crime, and in doing so, categorized it as a Class A felony, separately punishable. We could just as easily say that the judge decided to take into consideration the fact that this defendant had taken an appeal of the burglary conviction and had embarrassed him before the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals by having that court remind the trial judge that the guilty plea was constitutionally deficient. That is why it is important that the information that the trial judge rely upon be specifically stated as to the crime. Now, if you believe that what he stated was adequate, then test it by whether it was objective and whether it was new, whether it was anything at all that he didn't know before. All we have is he didn't know that there were 5 rapes. Now he knows that. That may justify enhancing the rape, but it shouldn't justify enhancing the burglary against the backdrop of those other factors. I'm suggesting, Your Honor, that you cannot divorce a determination in this case of whether the additional information was adequate from whether there existed indicators of a retaliatory motivation for this trial judge. To do so would simply give the trial judge a convenient excuse to mask his vindictiveness. He's always going to hear more at trial than he's going to get at the guilty plea. There's always going to be more about the flavor of the trial, of the offense itself, more details. So if he has a reason to be vindictive against this defendant in the first instance, all he needs say is, well, now I've heard more evidence at trial. I understand now you did 5 rapes. There were 2 or 3 other crimes. That is why the rule that we advance is not an absolute rule. It is a case-by-case proposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boyd. Mr. Bierberg, do you have rebuttal?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
Very well. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.